This was such a long and detailed conversation that I ended up splitting it into two separate episodes. So metafiction, stories within stories. When Mob is being tortured by Miles, he spirals through these various stories, and they seem to be, I think it's a stash box for a bunch of stories that Morrison hasn't written.
Yeah, because I think early on in Morrison's career, they were writing a lot of short science fiction stories for British comics publishers. Yeah. And a lot of British science fiction from the 80s is pretty apocalyptic in tone. I don't know if you're familiar with Judge Dredd.
A little.
Which is this, I am the law, judge, jury, executioner taking place in a near future where it's very grim and but also very satirical, very black comedy. And a lot of the stories, the main British comic that I think a lot of Americans think of is 2000 AD, which is a anthology. It's weekly or biweekly. And there are continuing features like Judge Dredd and lots of other continuing features and short stories, but very black humor, science fiction kind of stuff. And I see that in the Gideon Stargrave stories that are riffed on in that segment of the Invisibles, mm-hmm. where you're, you know, King Mob is seemingly retreating into these alternate realities as a defense mechanism against Sir Miles trying to pry his secrets out of him.
Yeah, but it's also a trap. He's drawing Sir Miles like Ormaz draws Ahriman into the world. He's drawing him deeper in so that he can trap him, because eventually he traps him.
And as Ragged Robin draws Quimper in.
And as Ragged Robin, so again, with the Ragged Robin 2008 conceit, she's in this tank writing this story, and she becomes psychologically trapped in the text. Like, she becomes entangled with the story, and it drives her crazy. She's literally in a tank.
Yeah.
But psychologically, she has a breakdown shortly after that.
She does have a mental break, and when she comes back into the past, doesn't she spend a couple of years in a mental hospital?
This is a weird thing about Robin. I think that she spends some time in a mental hospital in 2008, and that's where she meets Mason.
He's a character we haven't talked about.
But then she goes back in time, and it's he finds her, not again, because it's the first time he finds her, but for her, it's the second time. It's kind of like the King Mob Edith thing, right? Yeah. She goes back in time, and yes, I don't know if she's posing in the mental institution or if the time travel made her crazy, but I don't know how a random lady from 2008 shows up in 92, how she gets committed to a mental institution.
Yeah. It reminded
me of... Mason does
of,
say that I found her in a mental institution.
The movie 12 Monkeys.
Yeah.
Which is based on the old experimental film. But that Bruce Willis's character, who travels back in time in a very similar way, ends up in a mental institution. Because what would you do with somebody who was from the future? You'd think they were crazy.
And she's sprung from that. From the chronologically first.
La Jetée is the name of the French experimental movie. If you've never seen it, you should. It's wonderful.
I don't know it. She's sprung by John of Dreams in 92, and she's sprung by Mason in 2008.
Yeah, and I will just say that
both
Mason,
times to be inducted into the Invisibles.
Mason Lang is a character who really only is in volume 2 of the series, the American
He
section.
Almost takes it over, though.
He's very present in it because he is a billionaire invisible who had an alien abduction experience as a child, which was his awakening to the way the world is. As I said before, the book, everybody gets the kind of awakening that they're conditioned by their culture to expect. So his is very traditional gray aliens taking him up to probe him and stuff.
Yep.
But he is very much, and the comic almost, I think, explicitly says this, he's basically Bruce Wayne. He is Batman in this narrative, a billionaire who's secretly funding and trying to help the Invisibles against the Outer Church. He is funding the time travel research that this Japanese scientist character Takashi is working on. And he tricks the government by giving, you know, they come to take his time travel tech and he gives it to them.
It just increases their need or desire for his technology 10 or 15 years later.
Right.
Right.
And he knows that's what's going to happen. Yep. And there are points in volume two where you're meant to not know what side Mason's on. Is he actually a villain or not? But he's not.
Or is he just orchestrating the whole thing as a film because he's a film buff?
Right. He's obsessed with movies volume two is very much movies.
Yeah.
It's like a comic book version I think Morrison must have thought if Quentin Tarantino were to make the Invisibles, what would it be like? And then that's what the comic
Black
is.
Black Science is like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the thing is, Mason, he is on some level orchestrating the whole thing because he inducts Ragged Robin in 2008 into the Invisibles.
Yeah.
And then she goes back in time, delivers the time machine, defeats Quimper, right? Reconnects with Mason. He's not orchestrating it the way we're led to believe, which is that he's just sort of like a producer director type.
Right. But once again, you know, all of these little characters that are not presented as the central characters of the series, you can see from their point of view how instrumental they are.
Yeah.
You know, like it doesn't work without him. It doesn't work without any of, you know, they're all necessary.
Yeah. We were talking about the writer being trapped in the text, and I'm pretty sure that that's something Robin says to Mob in 98 or 99, before she time suits back into the future. She says something like, I was afraid that I'd get trapped inside my own story, and here I am. I'm trapped in the story.
Here's a funny side story about that. For his first US comic book, Morrison wrote a series called Animal Man, which was a minor character from the 1960s who could adopt the powers of any animal he was near. So if there was
and
a
Morrison
bird flying,
is like rehabbing this character for the
correct.
Okay.
You know, at the time, it was in vogue to take these corny old 1960s characters and
like
make them more realistic and darker. And throughout that series, I think it goes 26 issues. Horrible things happen to Animal Man, and his family gets killed, and ultimately, it all leads to him coming face to face with Grant Morrison, the writer.
Right.
And they have an issue long dialogue between the two of them. Why did you do these things to me? Well, I thought that's what the audience wanted, back and forth. Ultimately, he resets everything. But what's funny about this is that a few years later, another writer said, oh my God, Morrison, do you realize the fact that you put yourself into a comic means that DC Comics owns the comic book version of you and they can do anything they want with you? I'm going to fix that. John Ostrander was the writer. He was writing a comic called Suicide Squad, which was the conceit of it. It was like the Dirty Dozen in comic book form, in which a bunch of various supervillains the government sent them on deadly missions. If you survive the mission, we'll let you go. You might get killed. And if you try to escape, there's a bracelet on your neck that'll blow your head off. And he wrote into the series a character, the writer, who is the Grant Morrison character from that Animal Man issue. And his power is, as they're in the middle of a fight, he's like typing and then this bad guy falls out of a tree, but ultimately he gets killed.
Sure.
So he got rid of that character so that DC couldn't.
That's great.
You know, I just thought that was super funny.
It's a great piece of like corporate internal terrorism, self-protection or whatever.
Yes.
It's also like writerly solidarity in a weird way.
Right. He
shot the hostage.
It's tongue in cheek because I assume that DC could bring back the writer anytime
they
wanted
to. Because they could bring back it. Yeah.
But as a gesture, it was pretty funny.
Yeah. Again, with the sort of hyper-sigilistic magic, right? My last thing about the metafiction thing, and this is a question I have about the book. So Grant Morrison is writing the Invisibles but the Invisibles, inside the world of the Invisibles, is also a story being told by Dane to Gaz at the end of the world.
Or is now, a book that this Ragged is Robin read.
So we know that Ragged Robin read The Invisibles sometime between, you know, 2000 and 2008.
And Kirk Morrison and then, wrote The Invisibles?
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at. She says that she fell in love with the picture on the back and that she wanted to meet him. And her friend says, oh, you know, he'd be so old now. But maybe she's talking about, because Miles Delacorte wrote The Invisibles also. That was an expose of the 1920s Invisibles. Yeah. And then, so, but I thought this. I thought that what happened was Robin read The Invisibles, and it was by Kirk Morrison.
Yes.
And she wrote the fan fiction, and she falls in love, and then she goes back in time and literally falls in love with the guy who's Kirk Morrison, who's King Mob.
Right.
And that, because we don't see King Mob. King Mob is missing. From 99, he leaves with Helga after the big ritual, and then he doesn't appear again until 2012.
And I will say Helga, for those of you who have heard that name come up a couple times, is just a member of the Invisible Cell that comes in, who's not really well defined or developed.
Mr. Six brings her in.
Yeah. She has a lot to do in Volume 3, but I never really get a good grasp on
her. She's a language expert.
Yeah.
And I think that she and Mob develop Technocult.
Yeah.
I suspect that her language manipulation skills, she's like a propagandist or like an ad exec.
It's me. I think that by that point, I'm like, I've been introduced to enough new characters. Right, I can't really connect with this one. This is just another one.
Yep. Anyways, my sense is that Mob wrote The Invisibles as a love letter. Because, I mean, so Kay is like 12, and she's going to become Robin, and they're going to fall in love in Mob's past. But in order to secure that, he needs to, again, with the causal loop, in order to secure that relationship and the success of the sect or the cell, he has to write The Invisibles. But then going back through and looking for it, I can't actually find evidence that Morrison wrote The Invisibles. I can only find evidence that she read The Invisibles and fell in love with the author.
Well, and then
and
there's
the author is too old for her, but that could be Miles.
Then there's the other throwaway gag of King Mob in San Francisco in 1997 or whatever, reading an issue of what is clearly The Invisibles. The comic book cover
it's Black Science.
Is from like two or three issues earlier and saying, oh, this is ridiculous.
Yep.
There's no way to really explain that other than that's just a gag.
I agree that it's a gag, but it serves, like any good gag, it serves this larger motif.
There's a truth to it.
This metafictional motif.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, I don't think that the versions of the Invisibles that the characters are creating or reading are exactly the same as the one we are creating or reading, but it's like a, I don't know, the infinite recursion mirror kind of thing.
Sure,
like
And some of that's just play, but some of it is very heavily themed stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get at pregnancy, birth, rebirth, miscarriage. I also noted in just flipping through my notes, we skipped the Archons, which maybe we can come back to. We don't need to. I was struck on this read how strident the pregnancy, birth, rebirth, miscarriage theme is. And here are just a couple bits of that. Edith has a miscarriage.
On the steps of
whose
the
child,
in India.
Whose the father is open to interpretation because she's notoriously promiscuous.
Right.
But it could be Mob's kid.
Yep.
And I know that Morrison is on the record talking about some of this stuff in relation to his relationship at the time of writing the thing.
Yeah, there was something in his personal life where he was working through that.
Right.
Were working
and
through
the Quimper thing is related to that, but I'm not talking about Quimper right now. Yeah. But what's interesting is that it's a yucky scene where Edith has the miscarriage on the stairs, but it's also pivotal in many of the time shift scenes when Mob is outside of time, he's about to open the door onto that scene, or he's like at the top of the stairs and he can see Edith and she's about to open a door, and it's right before the miscarriage, and what.
And then all those years later, that's where she meets him as a young writer who had just broken up with Jackie, right? Back on those stairs. He's sitting there looking at
the... Oh, it's different stairs, though.
Okay.
I think, unless it's the same stairs, I never considered I never considered that those stairs were in India.
Okay.
Well, she's old when she meets him.
Right. Right.
I assume that was like at the Ritz or something.
Oh, okay.
The stairs where she had the miscarriage. But the there's
it's a big book, folks.
I know. There's a gentleman who scoops the fetus up into his hat, mm-hmm. and he says, "Look at it's moving its fingers. I think it's trying to be born." And that quote is so important to this book because this book is about human consciousness trying to be born and the potential for
into our next phase.
Yeah, and the potential for miscarriage.
Yeah.
Right?
That we're not born yet and it could go wrong.
Yep.
And at the end, the villains are trying to birth this evil thing into the world that's going to send everything off the rails. Yep. There is a sense I get that's doomed to failure. They don't know it yet. That the conflict, I mean, the Invisibles show up at the church to try to stop it. But I always got this impression that was a foregone conclusion. That
it is because Miles always intends to just shoot the monster and make Dane the vessel.
Yeah.
And that monster, which is the child of some royal people and some archon or some
this extra. Is one thing about this book in the time that it came out, early on there are references to Diana, and I think Morrison loved Diana the moon goddess.
That's actually perfect. Very compelling. And I didn't connect that until I read The Invisibles.
She is going to be used to usher in this evil baby. And then Diana actually dies in real life.
I know.
And the book refers to that. They're like, that was our plan A, and now we've got to move. But this will be better anyway.
There's a point at some point, some character who's working for the royal family says something like, "Do you have any idea how hard it was to track down a virgin whose name was Diana specifically for Charles?"
Yes.
And
there is an example of what I was talking about at the beginning. When you're writing a book in chapters over years.
Yeah.
You can't plan for what actually happens.
Right.
And if part of your plot is dependent on that and it goes sideways, you've got to, Morrison wrote their way out of it, in a very amusing way.
Yeah.
But that's tricky to be that kind of writer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most comics traditionally, historically are just punch 'em ups that, you know, go on forever and don't have finite conclusions in mind. In fact, you don't ever want one because you want to be selling Superman comics
forever.
But as the audience developed that was a little bit older to be able to take this kind of material and they knew they could sell it, the idea that we're going to tell finite stories was very different for comics.
Yeah. So another, just a couple more pregnancy birth things. Robin is pregnant before she time travels back to 2012, pregnant with Mob's child.
Mm-hmm.
And she never totally, she gets back to 2012, but in the super context.
Yeah. And we never get to see what happens once she gets back. You know, as far as I can remember.
Oh, she embraces King Mob. He says, "I'm ready to play with the grown-ups."
Yeah, well, I mean.
And she's, her language is all, like, it's all mixed up. The
yes,
words are
but
all.
But what I'm talking about is when she first gets into the time suit and she is going to go back to the past, the King of Tears breaks in. The Archons, they're going to lay waste to these Invisibles and stop them from their plan.
Yeah.
She gets away and goes back to the present of the comic, does all her stuff, but her ultimate goal is to get back to that moment to help save her team from the Archons. But I don't think we ever see her do that.
I think her return is the same as the super context commencing.
Okay.
And her arrival, you know, I think it's December 22nd.
So it's right
22nd.
at that
I think it's
moment.
It's the solstice of 2012.
Like, things are going to start to disintegrate.
Yeah.
So
she returns, but it kind of not. Because everything kind of collapses into itself.
Yeah. There's, it's fascinating. The story says, as I said before, everybody will get to experience that end and rebirth in their own way. There's a weird little short story. We're all policemen, which is King Mob just living in this fabulous world that's very much like the world that he was imagining for Gideon Stargrave of celebrities and, you know, fashionable spies. And at the end of that story, all the light bulbs from the paparazzi go off. And that's the super context coming.
Yeah.
Like that's his fantasy as he ascends when after Robin comes back out to get him and embraces him. And I never understood that until reading through this time.
Yeah. That's a very hard little thing to understand, that short.
Yeah. I mean, and there are elements of this comic that do not, they want you to do the work.
Yeah.
That's one of the things I really like about Morrison's work in general. They are pretty elliptical sometimes. There are series I've read by them that I still don't understand to this day. That are just read them over and over again. And I'm like, what are they trying to say? How did that tie together? I know it has to make sense somehow. I'm just not seeing it yet.
Yeah. And it can click years later.
Yeah.
Or like sometimes when you're not even looking at the book. Barbalith is the placenta to the cosmic child. And the end of the book, this is the same time, like Robin arrives back in 2012, the super context arrives, and that is at the same moment that like an astronaut punctures Barbalith. It seems to he reaches out and he touches it and it seems to explode. And then hopefully rebirth or a new kind of consciousness occurs.
Right. And Barbalith is both this weird orb circle hanging in the sky, but also very literal in that when characters encounter it and they haven't had their consciousness, it's red.
Red for stop.
And then it goes green.
Green for go. Yeah, I know. And sometimes it's even yellowish orange one time for Dane.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good example of how like these deep... the potential reality that's more profound than we can perceive with our senses, how we have to dumb it down. Like it has to be as simple as a light, as the same way that like whatever aliens are in the 50s, they are obviously men in spacesuits and with powerful military technology. And now they're shifting into something a little different because we have to understand those things as the sphere intersects with our plane of consciousness. Yeah. It has to be a circle. Something really simple.
The first time I encountered that idea was Carl Sagan had a book of essays called The Demon Haunted World.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might have been the last book published by him. But talking about the connections between alien abduction stories and the stories of people who claim they had seen the Virgin Mary.
Yeah, or fairies.
And that they are nearly identical stories.
Yeah, except the iconography is different.
The iconography is different, but the people who tell those stories tend to be from the same strata of society. You know, people without a lot of voice or power.
Yeah.
And it gets them some notoriety and power. You know, if you're a little farm girl in 15th century France in the field and you tell everybody that the Virgin Mary came to you, people are looking at you now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And if you're just some family in Kentucky who says the aliens invaded, that's a story. And
yeah.
Somebody from the paper might come. And not, you know, these stories are in the same way that Morrison had an abduction experience that eventually I believe it's like, well, don't take that literally. It's not like actual, you know, but something consciousness raising did happen to me there.
And they use in this text a lot of times when there are untranslatable things, Morrison will sometimes bracket using square brackets the idea. And it'll like an alien will say, I've just inserted a, and then bracket into your brain. And inside the bracket will be like chip/stone/ magic key.
Right.
Because those are all just things that we could use as metaphors for the untranslatable thing.
And that is one of the magics of this as a comic book that I can't think of anywhere else where that would come through as easily. I guess you could do it in prose, but the fact that you were looking at pictures that people drew of, and the whole idea behind that key 17 drug, which is very similar, that we will inject you with something and then show you a word and you will think you are seeing the thing itself.
Yep.
That seems to be connected to that idea of this slash that slash the other thing.
The instability of the signifier to actually get
right.
Signifiers like words, they hover around a meaning rather
than
getting
at it. And if you are reading this comic book, which is drawn by many hands, you are seeing, let's say, King Mob.
Yeah.
As drawn by Steve Yowell, three issues later, as drawn by Jill Thompson, as drawn by Phil Jimenez, as drawn by Frank Quitely, any of the other artists who worked on the series. So you are seeing somebody's signifier of King Mob, quote marks in the air, but are you ever seeing the real King Mob?
Right, yeah.
You're only seeing versions of him filtered through other people's artistic talent and biases, I guess. It's one of the things that I like about it, the way it's structured as a comic book with multiple creators.
Sacrifice. I'm going to list them all, and then we should talk about some of them, maybe not all of them. Here, okay. Here's my total list of sacrificial things in this book. The fox hunt motif, and the fox is a sacrificial animal, and then the fact that there's a character, like a pop star character later called Shay Fox, who is weirdly linked up with but is not identical with this character whose name is Reynard, which is, I think, the folk legend name of the fox in France and French and English stories. Yeah. Yep. Reynard is the fox. And I think that Reynard dies. I think Reynard maybe kills herself, because there's parts of that final issue that are worded there. Clearly it's Reynard's diary. Mm-hmm. And then at the end it says, if you're reading this, I'm already dead. And, and that's a drag, because Reynard is kind of an innocent character. Miles Delacorte sacrifices himself. Before he does that, he sacrifices hundreds of children and homeless people. Barbalith, which I just discussed, the death of the placenta character. The placenta must die for the child to live. And that's like Universe B, or the Outer Church. As the Venn diagram separates, something will die. And that is the, like, all the stuff in the Outer Church, it's yucky and it's sinister and it's evil, but it's just decaying. It's just dying as the more pure world is born. Takashi sacrifices an eye. His eye is slashed by villains. Beryl's hand and her body.
She is sacrificed by Miles.
Yep. Quimper is sacrificed, and the humanity of the gray alien and the dignity of the gray alien are sacrificed, and also Fanny's, because Fanny is raped in the same scene. Gaz is sacrificed. I mean, it's not Gaz. No, it is Gaz. So Gaz is the same character that was neutered and tortured in the house of, what's it called? I just had the house of
Harmony House.
Harmony House, right. And Gaz is sacrificed. He says it like, my childhood was taken away from me, as he's dying in Dane's arms at the end of the series.
As you're making this list, I'm thinking of the difference in the story between characters who sacrifice themselves
and who are sacrificed,
and those who are sacrificed. Yeah. And it is the villainous characters who sacrifice others, typically.
Yeah.
Miles, who is just murdering all of these people, versus somebody like Tom O'Bedlam, who jumps off the building with Dane and is trying to help him become the next Buddha.
Yeah, right.
And he, somehow, for some reason, that has to include him shuffling off the mortal coil in order for that to happen.
Yeah, self-sacrifice is a good guy move. Although, killing others, you know, Mob obviously sacrifices a lot of characters, right? Best Man Fall character was my next thing. He's another character that's sacrificed for the story and for Mob, because his wife saves Mob's life. I mean, I don't know if that's necessarily related to his death, but...
Well, it's a weird... If you think about it in terms of karma, that's a real kind of strange thing, because she develops that kind of empathy as a result of her husband being murdered.
Yeah.
So that she gets into a place where years later she sees this guy bleeding out in a phone booth or whatever it is.
Yep.
And she is driven to help him, to get him to a hospital. Oh, wow. It turns out we know, as the reader, that's the guy who killed her husband and caused the conditions for her to want to reach out and help a stranger.
Right.
He doesn't deserve it. You know, like, based on those interactions, he doesn't deserve it, but he gets it.
Right.
And, that's part of the whole story, that we're all one and good and evil kind of mushed together.
And the final sacrificial character is the most obvious, and it's Jesus, right? There's a lot of references to Jesus, especially in the Dane arc. The Last Temptation of Jack is a play on The Last Temptation of Christ, and he does encounter Barbalith in the form of Jesus. The suggestion, I think, being that an innocent character that is also God, which is arguably every character in this book, must die in order to redeem itself and the condition of characters.
One of the most minor characters in the book in terms of their appearances is this unnamed guy who gets picked up in a car and... You didn't say your name. No, I didn't. And then later there's a, somebody's listening to a radio call-in program and somebody comes.
Yeah.
And I think that's Jesus. I think in the story, in the same way that Satan kind of floats through the story, I think you have this Jesus figure.
The holy hobo.
Who moves through. The other sacrifice is the butler dude in the issue where the Moonchild is given people to devour, and he is responsible for wheeling those people in to be eaten by this creature. And then at the end, he's on a silver platter.
Yeah.
And it's so creepy where they're like, "Are you bothered by this?" He's like, "Oh no, I think he likes me."
And that character, without getting into the whole plot of that issue, which is really kind of heavy, he is a failed invisible operative. He's been placed there to kill this monster, and
he can't do it.
Yeah. But instead, he sacrificed.
And then he, his daughter is in danger, and then it turns out that she hates him, and she is working with Sir Miles, and then Sir Miles has her killed anyway. Very unpleasant people.
Yeah.
But there are. Early on, it's clear that Morrison wanted to be able to tell both the story of his cell of invisibles, the main characters, and also be able to go off anywhere in the world and tell little short stories. And I think those are some of the most effective stories in the whole series. The one about Jim Crow, the one about the Moonchild and that butler, the one about the Last Man Fall story about the henchman who gets killed by King Mob. I think there's one more. Those open up the world in a very important way, I think. And it's a shame to me that those go away. The narrative becomes a lot more streamlined in volume two as you just see what your heroes are doing. And it sort of plows through.
Yeah.
I think the book lost something a little bit when, whether that was purely Morrison's creative decision or a publishing reality, this is going to be harder to sell and keep the sales up month to month if you keep jumping around to people we've never seen before. But in the same way that The Sandman had that, and there would every once in a while be a story about a cat. Or about Orpheus, those expand the universe of the book in a really interesting way, which is why Volume One tends to be my favorite volume. I think it's the most ambitious structurally.
I wasn't necessarily going to ask the question of what's your favorite, but because for me
it doesn't really matter.
It doesn't, but I do have like a weird. Ambivalence toward volume two, because I think it is my favorite of the three, but it's not because of the shoot 'em up stuff. It's because of the Ragged Robin arc.
Yeah.
That's just so vital to the plot and it's such a mind fuck. But I could really do without some of the gore and some of the like over the top conspiracy stuff, but like the idea that Mob what's her name? Jolly Roger can walk into this facility and kill like, you know, 5-6 dozen dudes and escape with the AIDS vaccine.
Right. It's just, again, it's the Tarantino version of this thing. In volume one, it felt like the heroes' achievements were harder to come by. They had to work harder for them. Yeah. Here, that kind of action is, and it's a, you're seeing it. It's also a critique of it.
But explicitly it's, a self-critique. At one point, they are dosed with some chemical that puts them into auto-critique mode, where each character speaks about the contradictions of their depiction.
Yeah.
That's a miraculous moment.
Yeah. And it's always nice to see the creators being really self-aware.
Yeah.
You know, that you were like, oh, okay, yeah, they're in control of this narrative. They know what they're doing. And that's definitely the case through most of this book.
I want to mention the illusions, and I want to talk about the questions and then do Golden Sentence, and we should wrap it up.
Yeah, okay.
All right. In no particular order. Nice and smooth, which is that's King Mob's catchphrase, and something that What's-His-Face says from the Kinks.
It's Ray Davies the Kinks.
Right. At the beginning of a song.
At the head of the song David Watts. Mm-hmm. Fa, 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 David Watts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Coolest Shaker. That's a funny one. At one point, Mob is listening to the new Coolest Shaker record.
Yeah, I think that was maybe just Morrison very pop conscious. You know, Morrison in the early 80s had been a member of a mod band, the Mixers, mm-hmm. that was putting out singles. And I think there's always sort of attention paid to fashion and popular music. And I think they're just trying to like pull out.
It's just so funny what he...
Here's a new record.
It's just so funny what Morrison picked compared to what... if they had had the hindsight of 20 years, what they might have picked,
yeah.
Right? Alan Watts, the book, that's not cited explicitly in this book, but it's something that I'm drawn to when I read it. I've never read The Outsider, but Colin Wilson, Miles Delacorte is depicted reading that book at one point. Miles is also reading Phil Hine. That's a strange thing for him to be reading. Mumbo Jumbo by Ishmael Reed, I mentioned. Divine Horseman by Maya Deren. Robert Shea and Robert Wilson's The Illuminatus Trilogy. Sir Miles is very much like the arch-villain of those books, very much, to the point of, like, you know, doing sacrifices in order to prove one's allegiance to the Lovecraftian forces of human consumption or whatever. And the obsession with the 23 enigma, this book is always on, everything's 23. It's the roulette wheel's always coming up 23, the airplane has 23, everything's got 23
on it.
Yeah,
there's some numerology stuff going on here.
23, that comes up a lot in the Illuminatus trilogy. Obviously, the 120 Days of Sodom by de Sade.
Yep.
Jolly Roger's reading David Icke in one scene. She's reading a David Icke book while they're with El-Fayed.
I am having trouble coming up with another series like this that has that many books being, like, real books being read by characters at various points.
Yep. And then the Smiths, heaven knows I'm miserable now. Caligula would have blushed. That's the lyric that Mob is listening to when he meets Edith Manning in India.
Yeah.
And that's not right after, but it's in the wake of his breakup with Jackie.
And it's such sad bastard music. Mm-hmm. It's like perfect for some pale British dude in the 80s whose like heart is broken.
Right.
You're
going
to be listening to Morrissey.
Yep.
I already mentioned the Jack Kirby New Gods stuff. Yep. I think that's a pretty heavy illusion. I also think that the invisible cell doesn't behave or look the way it does without the X-Men. I think the idea of them, you know, this is both not at all a superhero story, but it's also kind of a superhero story in some ways. These are larger than life characters with powers and
young, very talented,
and they have
fighters.
Looks, you know?
Yeah, totally.
I don't think you could draw one-to-one analogs between any of these characters and say the X-Men, but I think a group of outsiders shunned by society, sort of, who are kind of on the run and fighting the good fight.
You say that you can't draw one-to-one parallels, but have you considered it? Because I don't know the X-Men well enough to do it, but that seems like the sort of thing that would be fun to do.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many different iterations of X-Men teams.
Is Dane Wolverine?
Yeah, it's so hard. I would say maybe in some ways King Mob
is Wolverine. That's right.
He's the like hyper violent, but he
loses control,
has a troubled soul because he's conflicted about the violence he's inflicting, but on the other hand also thinks it's necessary. Lord Fanny, she's a queen in her regality. She's kind of like Storm, mm-hmm. the weather witch. Dane, in some ways, is like the X-Men often has entry point characters like Dane is. In the very first issue of the X-Men comic from the 60s, Marvel Girl joins the team. The other four guys, Cyclops, the Angel, the Beast, Iceman, they're already students at the school, mm-hmm. and she shows up and they're like, hey, and they want to show off for her. And then later in the 70s, the established team gets a new member, Kitty Pryde. She's like a 13-year-old girl who can walk through walls. And for the next 40 issues, she's kind of the viewpoint character. He kind of fills that role of the young kid who's joining the established team. Ragged Robin. Well, she is, I believe, based on visually on Jill Thompson, the artist, but conceptually Morrison had been writing for DC Comics, a superhero book called Doom Patrol that had a character named Crazy Jane who had multiple personality disorder, and each of the personalities had a different power set. And I believe Morrison really liked writing that character. And when it came to write Invisibles, was like, well, I'll write a character that's kind of like her.
Yeah.
She didn't end up being quite like that, but I can see the connection point.
How it starts. Yeah.
Yeah. And, I mean, I couldn't begin to figure out who she would be on the X-Men, but I just think that the idea of a 5 or 6 member team, each of one has their own special skills, whether it's the X-Men or the Teen Titans or any of those kinds of like fashionable teams of young people.
When Heather and I were talking about The Secret History by Donna Tartt, which is not a superhero book, it's a dark academia book about college intrigue. It's a 5-person set. And I was making that comparison. It's like this comfortable set of a comfortable set of characters for a dynamic team of heroes.
Yeah. And you can have, with 5, you can have them bounce off each other and form friendships and alliances or rivalries in ways that keep the narrative engine running for a long time.
There's a fair amount of bands, too, that are 5-piece, right? Vocalist, 2 guitarists, a bassist, and a drummer. A lot of rock band, 5-person rock bands. I want to, for those of you out there who are doing research paper, or for those of you who are writing literary analysis, I want to name check some of the symbols. And as I was doing it, I really settled on one. So I'll just name check some and then talk a lot about this one. Blue Mold, I don't know if I want to get into it, but Tom of Bedlam, part of his initiation of Dane involves smoking this blue mold that is growing down in a mysterious vestibule of the transit system under the city that no one knows. I'm not totally sure what the function of blue mold is, but I'll just mention it. Scorpion comes up a lot. Mob's got a scorpion tattoo at the base of his spine, and Scorpion Loa, Scorpion God's Key 17 is a drug. It's later called Key 23. I can't tell if it's a different thing.
Like they've evolved it since 17. It's maybe like a different iteration of it. Yeah.
I don't know. That's a shout, or that's a callback, I think, to Sam Delaney's book, Babel 17, which is about a linguistic virus that functions similarly, that you can use language, descriptive language, as almost like imperative language, like kind of like what you said about the writer, the character of the writer, who as he writes, those things manifest, which is, again, that's kind of almost like a comprehensive theme in this book, is writing to manifest. That's like a function of magic. But the symbol that comes up the most is masks. And I think that's because we're all masks worn by God in the great game, hashtag non-dualism. But here's just some examples of it. At the horrible rich guy party where Fanny and the alien are brutalized, they're all wearing animal masks.
Yeah.
Which is very sinister, very sinister. And I tried to track the masks because Quimper has a mask hanging in his office at the strip club. I think it's a pig mask, but I don't think it might be the same mask. George wears a pig. He puts the pig mask on in Mr. Six and Half Dozen. I don't remember that now that I'm reading.
King Mob wears a mask, yeah, which is like this looks like a ceremonial headdress or something with like white fur feathers on it, and almost like a
which, and those fur feathers actually also contain barbed wire. We don't find that out until the third volume, but he could use them as a weapon. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that mask covers it. It reflects others, right? It's like a big space helmet almost that reflects others, and it doesn't allow us to see Mob himself. And that mm-hmm. says a lot about Mob as someone who's projecting violence, right?
Right.
Quimper has a mask, and he is sort of transforming, or being led to believe that he's transforming Robin into a new sort of superhero whose name might be Ugly Face, right? She's going to become Ugly Face instead of being Robin. Fanny wears that Quimper mask, and Fanny changes face often. Fanny puts on different wigs, and uses makeup to transform from like the male presenting version of Lord Fanny to the female presenting version.
And Jimenez makes a big point of when Fanny is presenting male, showing with stubble and sort of signifiers of maleness.
Yeah, and I always took that to be that Fanny just hasn't had a chance to shave, but you're right. Yeah. It's important as a signifier of masculinity, right? Mm-hmm. When Mason is abducted as a kid, he imagines himself or is depicted walking through a hallway covered in masks. Reminds me of the scene in Return to Oz. You ever see Return to Oz?
Yes.
Where there's that hallway with all the heads. And then Robin wears a mask of makeup.
Yep.
Right. And I'm sure I'm missing some, but masks is like the fiction suit. It's a signifier of maybe the main theme of the book.
Who doesn't really wear a mask is Dane, Jack Frost. Good,
yeah, important.
He is himself, and that is something that sets him apart. All of the other characters consciously adopt different identities. Like, their whole self becomes a mask. Gideon Starowski, Kirk Morrison, right. King Mob, these are all these different layers of masking. But I don't think it's necessarily, that's not negatively thought of. It's like, it's great. You can be anybody you want to.
Yeah.
You can invent yourself and be this person and who wasn't anything like you used to be. Isn't that wonderful?
We're plural.
Yeah.
Our identities are not fixed. Whereas Sir Miles is kind of like the archons of control that he serves. He's very much in favor of a world of fixed identities and fixed meanings.
Yeah. And Dane steps outside all of it. He deepens. He doesn't quite, you know, he evolves, but I don't think there's no artifice to him ever, really.
Sure.
He's just who he is.
And this many persona thing sort of culminates in the final issue, where it's revealed that King Mob and Technocult have created a video game that you play by ingesting an aerosol. And when you ingest it, you basically live out the Invisibles playing as whatever character you want to play. Some of the characters, too, there's some shots in that last issue that I don't even know which characters it's referring
to.
No,
yeah. It's...
They're like random walk-ons. You could play as anyone.
I will say, you could play as somebody who wasn't even part of the book. There are a few places in the original comics towards the end where there are art issues where Morrison's ideas as the writer were not clearly translated by a couple of the artists that were picked to draw the last few issues of the book. As it gets closer to the conclusion, like issues 4, 3, and 2 become kind of art jam issues where multiple artists are drawing the same issue, and they might get 3 pages, 2 pages, a spread. And there are a couple artists that are called upon to draw really complex ideas, which maybe no fault of theirs, but they just didn't nail it to the point where in the collected edition that John has, those pages are replaced with another artist who was seen to have drawn in a clearer style to more easily convey what Morrison was trying to get across. There is something that runs through the book that the dimension that we inhabit is our perception of who we are and what we are is limited by our experience of moving through time in one direction. And you get to see in the book at a few points when Robin emerges from the super context, or when Dane is having the nature of reality explained to him, characters sort of mirrored in time. You see a figure as like almost a snake.
A centipede
self that extends back into the past. And the idea that, you know, we're moving through time the way a seed is growing in soil, and so that we can eventually emerge from time into this timeless super context where we're all unified together. But we can't see time from outside it the way I can reading a comic book, and I can see Dane in a panel on this page, five pages earlier in a panel on another page doing something else. But that seems pretty important to the sort of the book's conception of what people are, that we start from our birth and we kind of snake our way through time as these super long time worms to get to wherever we are right now.
Yeah.
And that's something that's hard to draw. it's hard to describe, let alone draw it. So I have to give credit to all the army of people who brought this to life on the page.
Yeah. You ready to talk about just some stuff I like? I just want to mention the two things I like. Yeah, I like a lot of it, right? There's a time distortion sequence that comes up maybe two or three times where Mob runs into Dane, and Dane is boiling a green glove.
Yeah.
It's like, just what the fuck? I just don't know what it means. And it's weird because the green glove is not the Hand of Glory, but the Hand of Glory is a green hand.
Right.
And it's because I think the thing is Mob is not around the Invisibles from 99 to 2012. And that scene seems to take place in that time. Mm-hmm. But it's not clear why Dane is boiling the glove. And in at least one scene, Dane speaks just gibberish.
Yeah, I love that there are still things about this book, having read it three or four times, that I'm like, what the fuck is this? I cannot piece this into the narrative in a way that coheres for me. What is he on about? And I don't know. And that's fine.
Yeah.
It makes it feel bigger that there are some unsolved mysteries in it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I've talked about a lot of the things I really love about the book. I really like the transition from Phil Jimenez's art to Chris Weston as volume two goes on, because the first part of it is this hyper glossy, super sensational look. And then Weston's work is similar, but a lot grittier.
It's more contoured
and there's an unpleasantness to it.
Yeah, definitely.
I
dislike the way he draws King Mob sometimes.
Yeah, there's an ugliness.
Yeah,
it's
right.
Very well rendered, but like an intentional ugliness to it that all of Jimenez's characters are really pretty.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's all very idealized comic book anatomy and faces and Weston, there's a garishness to it that I think is appropriate, as we're meant to think that Quimper is getting his hooks deeper into Robin.
Yeah, totally.
Like the story is getting creepier.
Yeah.
So it fits that it looks creepier for a few
issues.
That
one scene where she has convinced Mob to pretend that he's the Archon of Control, and that he's got the gun to her head and he's sweating and she's got this look of like erotic delight. That's a brilliant picture, but Mob is so repulsive in that picture.
Yeah.
He looks satanic.
I think Morrison absolutely sticks the very ending of the last issue with Frank Quitely, the artist, who is a longtime collaborator of Morrison on some of their like higher level books, but I think only appears in the final issue, The Invisibles, to draw that whole issue, where King Jack Frost, Dane, looks at the reader and says, "Our sentence is up."
Yeah.
And like literally the sentence is over, period, as the world disintegrates to white, which is very effective on the comic page. Mm-hmm. Like everything's melting away. And one of the protagonists of the story is telling you, the reader, you're free.
Yeah.
If you get this story and you understand it and you embrace it, you can be free.
And what it must have felt like for Morrison to finish this like 5 year
you're never guaranteed you're going to get to finish it. I know many comic book series that looked like they had the ambition to run years with a point, and they get canceled at issue 10 or 12 or 15. And it almost happened with this book. I mean, I'm trying to think, you know, this would have been one of those, one of many series that is like dies in the cradle, you know,
Again, with the birth and miscarriage motif,
like these were,
he carried it
all
the way
through. What a fascinating 15 issues. And then it just stops.
Yeah.
That would have been really strange.
I'm very aborted attempt.
Grateful that this was given the opportunity to be seen to the conclusion. I think it eventually found its audience and started to grow its sales enough to sustain itself. I also think Morrison was, DC Comics saw Morrison as valuable beyond this series, because at the same time, halfway through volume two, Morrison starts writing Justice League, one of DC's biggest, and he turned it, Morrison turned it into one of their biggest comics. And demonstrated that they could sell books, like their bread and butter books, and went on to write many years of Batman stories. And so I think DC wanted to be in the Grant Morrison business.
Yep.
And if part of the cost of that is publishing a pet project like Invisibles, sure.
But let's also not underestimate the importance of the Wankathon. But let's not get into it. Listener, Google
look
it.
Look it up. Yeah.
Okay, I've got some questions, but a lot of them we've already dealt with, so I'm just going to run through them. What's up with Reynard? Does she kill herself? Why is she named Reynard?
It's a mystery to me.
But I think we're going to get into it a bit with your golden sentence, honestly. Mm. Who is Olga? I always wondered this. Mob leaves with this lady named Olga. Wikipedia says it's Helga's real name, so apparently Olga is Helga.
Okay. Again, every character has to have a secret identity.
Right, I know. The cloud photograph, I don't want to spend too much time on it, but there's one of the linchpins of Robin's time travel is that there's a cloud photograph. But what's weird about it is that it should be to me that the young Robin has a photograph of a cloud, but in the background is adult her. But that's not how it actually goes. It's actually some weird shit where, like, the cloud pattern that day that old time-traveling Robin and young non-time-traveling Robin both saw at the same time is identical to a cloud in a totally different part of the world at a different time,
right,
related to this notion that the universe that they're living in, which is the universe of this story, the graphic novel world, is a simulation, and that there are repeated lines of text. You know, like Mario clouds, they all look the same, scrolling.
But that doesn't really get dug
into. It doesn't play out very well. But Morrison avoids the obvious choice, which would be, I've got a photograph that I remember the day it was taken, and the woman in the background is older me.
Right.
That would be the obvious move.
Yeah, so, I think that there are a few dead ends in the narrative, and things that, like, you start to build it up, and they're like, okay, and you just sort of...
Yeah.
Move through it.
And then I was wondering, I kind of didn't really understand why Mob and Helga and Fanny, why they dig up Beryl. But I think it's just that they put Miles in the car with the skeleton just to mess with his head.
Yeah.
It seems like a lot of work to just mess with Miles.
Well, and as you said before, there's a lot of messing with Miles and then leaving him be.
Yeah.
Like, okay, go.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe because they understand that he has a role to play at the end, too.
Yeah, I think Helga in particular knows that, because Helga has some other weird occult things going on with Miles, because she ends up collecting his blood and semen after he hangs himself.
Mm.
And it's related to this whole Black Grail sort of mythogram that she's got working on. She's on some... That, again, that's part of a story that we don't see. Like, Helga's arc is huge. And it might go all the way up to 2012 with Mob and Technocult. Mm-hmm. She's like the beginning of Technocult.
But we only get glimpses.
Yeah, her command of image magic is what ultimately becomes Technocult. But I'm speculating because we don't know the story. Okay, and then my big question, I think, is related to your golden sentence. So if you're ready, I'm ready to share golden sentences. And as usual, I have some runners-up. And then I've got one that I picked.
Okay, so I have two. And the first one is, as I said before, it's we lied. This isn't a war. This is a rescue mission. Right. Where I think that that's the point at which Morrison is trying to raise the reader's consciousness after having built up all of this war between good and evil, is now letting you in on that doesn't exist. That's not real. Think bigger. And that's sort of a linchpin of the whole, the Morrison's point in doing this story this way, trying to make the reader an invisible, having this radical empathy for horror and, you know, understanding that if it really is true that we are all cells in a single organism, that means that the repulsive ones are too.
Right.
And we need to reconcile that.
So my question relates to that quote, and okay. I'm going to give a different iteration of that quote. On page 1192 from the Omnibus, the blind chessman to Dane in the Outer Church.
And that the blind chessman is another name for the character we referred to as maybe Satan.
Satan earlier, yeah.
Yeah.
He says to Dane, Quimper said I was to tell you something. He said, quote, once my name was John. I said, John, John, hiding in plain sight. That's not playing the game. And then it stops being the blind chessman's quotation, and it's Dane continues, because Dane is recounting this, and he says, and then Edith said to call on Buddha, but he didn't hear her properly. And now it's a rescue mission. Okay, so one thing about that that's weird is that just my name is John, and it's just one of those moments where... Have you read Neverending Story? You've at least seen the movie, right?
Yeah.
Okay, because part of the Neverending Story is that the text is saying, you, the reader, you're the... I am literally speaking to you. And it's funny in this case that it's my name, because it's one of those moments where the characters look out and they're like, John, John,
yeah.
hiding in plain sight. And I'm like, fuck. You know, so that's just
I'm not going to get that too often with a name like Cole.
I know, right? Yeah. When you get it, then you know the shit is
real. I'll be really freaked out, yeah.
Okay, but my real question with this is, it's a rescue mission. Who or what is being rescued?
I mean, my first instinct is to say we're all rescuing each other. that
from what?
That, well, humanity is being rescued from this, the fear and the isolation that comes with it.
Of the ego?
Yeah.
And the identity of the self as opposed to the external world.
Yeah.
And not a part of, but separate.
And
from.
It's this weird contradiction in the text, because on one hand, Morrison is taking pains to show with every character the liberating possibilities of adopting whatever identity you want.
Yeah.
On the other hand, is also saying there's no such thing.
Yeah.
And maybe those two things aren't as in opposition as I first thought.
Right.
If there's no such thing as a real fixed identity, then okay, you can be whoever you want until it's time for us to all merge.
Yeah.
Because it's play.
So other
serious
things,
play.
Other things that could be rescued. I think that it's God or the writer is being it's the same thing you just said in different words, right? From the delusion of multiplicity, being rescued from the same way that Kay is lost in the narrative. Or Morrison was lost in the narrative, right? Like when Morrison puts King Mob through all those crazy facial infection things that happen, and you know, in the first volume, they in real life were like getting sick. Their art was affecting their physical health.
I think that there is an interesting trick in the quote that you just said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you told me about this,
because the blind chessman, the way that is stated.
He said, once my name was John.
So was it Quimper who said that Quimper's name was John? Or did Quimper say the blind chessman's name was John? You could read it either way. Morrison may be asking you to read it both ways.
Yeah. And they're all white-suited characters.
And John of Dreams, as you see in flashbacks, was a character in a white suit.
Yeah.
And Morrison has said in interviews, look for the character in the white suit. They're all manifestations of John of Dreams.
And that's maybe kind of the one who's being rescued, because John of Dreams goes off the deep end.
Yeah.
The character goes off the deep end and basically becomes evil, as it were.
Except some of these evil characters, you know, John of Dreams shows up again as John of Dreams sort of at the end in Westminster Abbey, seeming evil, But as we've seen before, some of these white suited characters are evil in service of being midwives to the heroes becoming more than they were before.
Yeah.
And so is John of Dreams there because, okay, this is part of the chess game. I have to be here like the blind chessman was in order to push you along.
Yeah.
You need something to push back against. That'll be me. And then you'll get through.
To boost the immune system.
Yeah.
Right.
So my other quote.
Okay. Hold on. Wait. Okay, one more thing on the rescue mission. Because the other thing about the rescue mission is it relates back to the Ormazd Ahriman thing. Right? Like the thing to be rescued from the crucible of the world is the destructive force of darkness. Because it's purified in that process. Right? It's trapped there. But not to be destroyed. To be purified. Mm-hmm. And then to be extracted safely from the vessel.
Okay, so can I go with my
my
second choice?
Yeah.
There is a
scene.
Is
this the culminate, the one that you prefer, or is it just two of two?
It's two of two.
Okay, great.
I think that the first one I said captures at core the theme of the book. I think this one captures the attitude that goes with that theme. There is a scene where Lord Fanny says, "Reality can suck my dick, darling." And I think that attitude is what infuses and makes possible the idea that you can adopt any identity you want to because reality can suck my dick, darling. Mm-hmm. You're able to create yourself and manifest yourself in a constructive, positive, fun way, and whatever somebody tells you is the way things really are, you can make the world.
It's also tonally, like you said, it's very much in line with Dane's mannerisms throughout the book.
Yeah.
Right? Like, fuck off.
Well, and then as we talked about the two of them over the course of the series growing closer together, becoming dance partners, becoming friends, you really get the impression of them, you know, King Mob doesn't seem like he's friends with the rest of the cell.
Yeah, he's distant.
But the two of them click.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Dane drops his bullshit homophobia. She learns to appreciate him and his rough edges. It's lovely. There is something that we haven't talked about at all in this because it doesn't quite, I think intentionally, these characters don't fit well. They're eerie. The Harlequinade. Yeah. There are these two jester-like characters who Dane and Fanny go to for information.
But they're kind of three characters,
They're
right?
kind of three characters,
Two
yeah.
characters, maybe two different aspects of a third character who is present with them, but is maybe kind of the culmination
they're
a triad.
Yeah, they're very much outside normal time and the normal narrative.
Yeah.
And then there's a scene in volume three where, is it Mr. X?
Mr. Six.
Mr. Six interacts with them and then they turn into the King in Yellow and a couple of dwarves.
They also interact with Miles in Dreams too.
And they are potentially also John of Dreams or representatives of the super context come into our reality. And
they're also, I think, you know, black, white, and the non-binary combination of the two. Right.
Yep.
And they induct Mr. Six into some sort of higher mystery at the end that we're not privy to.
Right.
Down in the vestibule of the Transit Authority.
Where the blue,
where
mold,
the
was.
Blue mold was.
I think that there is a funny gag that happens with that blue mold where, oh yeah, this stuff is like hallucinogenic and will send you to a different place. But then sometimes this is just mold on the side of the wall.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe it's both. Maybe the story plays with that. Maybe it's just fucking with you and this is just mold.
Who's drawing volume three?
There are a number of different artists in volume three.
Someone really nails Mr. Six in that he's so great. His mannerisms in that scene are so hilarious. He just looks so funny with the cigar. Mm-hmm. You know me, I'll try anything twice, he says to them.
Philip Bond is an artist who draws some of that with Mr. Six. It's the one who drew Kill Your Boyfriend with Morrison. And it's very sort of chunky, cartoony. Yeah. drawing.
I liked it more this read.
Very appealing to me. I really like that style.
Because, you know, you get so used to Jimenez and who follows Jimenez?
Chris Weston.
Those two have such a similar style. Mm-hmm. Like you said, Volume 2 is so unified feeling. It's jarring to switch to Bond.
Right.
But I liked it a lot more this read.
Yeah. I mean, it vacillates between these realistic drawing styles and these super cartoony drawing styles.
Yeah, right,
but it manages to make it work for me, at least.
I like it. Okay. My golden sentences. So there's four, and I can't really decide which is the best one. I think I do have the best one, but I've already said it, so I'll give you them all.
Yeah.
This is the first one this is an order of the book.
So these are chronological as they appear.
Chronological, yeah, yeah. Character says this to Boy in her first solo issue. That's the thing about conspiracy nuts. You start off laughing at them, and then a strange thing happens. You wind up seeing them in the mirror. That's just kind of a funny thing about this book, and especially how it's aged. And I can relate. Someone says this. It's probably El Fayed to Dane. A perfected human soul is the ultimate weapon.
Yeah,
that's a
great.
Nice one. It's got like a fortune cookie vibe to it.
There's a great scene where El Fayed, who's one of the trainer characters, is teaching Dane, and Dane wakes up in an airplane.
Yeah,
and
he's going like Mach 3.
Yeah, and he's like, "Holy shit! Oh no!"
Yeah.
And El Fayed is like, "Well, you know, like, okay, Buddha,
right?
Figure this out."
Yeah. That's around the place where he says to him, "Perfected human soul is the ultimate weapon." This one is stuck in a bunch of text. So the real piece is we have to steal back the hallucination, but the whole chunk is this. This is Mob writing a letter. I think the most powerful and sophisticated hypnotic methods are being used right now to create the illusion we mistake for reality. The point is, of course, that those same effective weapons are at our disposal, and there are well-established techniques for fighting illusion. We have to steal back the hallucination, as a rich friend of mine once said. That's Mason. Right. Yeah. That's the first thing we have to do anyway. And that is the seed that turns into techno cult, right? Mm-hmm. His application of the same tools of propaganda toward some sort of liberatory model.
Well, and that's also very 1990s in that's when like culture jamming became
a
big thing. Like we're going to use
what's Adbusters?
Yes, Adbusters.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and that's and that harkens back to the surrealist and like the French letterist, and there's a tradition of subverting mass media or just like delivering the content with a spoonful of sugar. Again, I call it the Rage Against the Machine paradox, right? Like you got to get this communist, maybe we should call it, radical content out through Capitol Records or whatever, right?
Well, you know, I could see a situation where Grant Morrison spent a few hours sitting with somebody going, man, you got to understand, we're all one.
Yeah.
But instead delivered it in the form of this very attractive, fun to read comic book series.
Yeah. Right. And then this is the one that wins out, and it's said by Flint. The immune drives accelerated on impact, brackets, untranslatable concept. We went into shock, hid behind the billion masks of God. We've regenerated all but the deepest trauma sites. That's like, I can really spiral into that quotation with a lot of interpretations, but we've talked about it a lot.
Yeah, and I think that is a glimpse into Morrison revealing themselves as a human being right there. Mm-hmm. Like there's something very esoteric and like jumbled about that, but it's also we've regenerated all but the most serious trauma. I mean, that's...
Right, yeah.
There's some things that you'll never be able to get to that are too painful.
And if like the universal consciousness could solve them, we would cease to exist. We would become the super context. Mm-hmm. All things would collapse back into a singularity.
Yeah. And I don't know. I mean, I think that is in line with the whole idea I had about this being a comic metaphorically about overcoming fear and the division that brings. I think you know, I think there are parts of this that Morrison may mean literally, and there are parts of it that really can be taken metaphorically. And if you want to just sort of go, okay, let's be normal about this and take this metaphorically, that's what I think it's getting at.
Yeah.
Is, you know, we'd all be better off if we had deeper empathy for one another. Mm-hmm.
Word. Good place to stop.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. This has been very much fun.
Cool. Okay, so Cole knows a lot about comics. And as listeners to this podcast know, I dramatically trim my and my guests' summarization of the book at the beginning in order to create a 3-minute flash summary. But in the case of this discussion, there's some important stuff said that I think is worth appending here at the end. So here's a couple outtakes. First off, here's Cole on the relationship of the Invisibles to the Vertigo comic imprint.
Just to provide a little bit of context, this is a comic that was published by the Vertigo imprint of DC Comics. And Vertigo was an imprint that had sprung out of DC's horror and mystery comics, that it had been publishing different kinds of horror and mystery comics all the way back into the 1950s. But it wasn't until the Swamp Thing comic was introduced in the early 1970s that it kind of took on a slightly different cast. Then in the early 1980s, when Swamp Thing was taken over by the Vermont artist Steve Bissett and the British writer Alan Moore, that it became something more literary, more ambitious, and then just sort of pulp, scary adventures. And the success of that over time led to a spinoff of a character within Swamp Thing, John Constantine, who is a magical, an occultist, not exactly a detective, but he wandered the world, you know, confronting demons and solving magical problems. And then Neil Gaiman, the British author, started the Sandman comic. And there grew sort of a critical mass that led to the creation of this imprint, Vertigo, where DC said, okay, we're going to keep DC for our superhero comics and the more mainstream stuff. And we know we have a market of older teenagers, young adults who want more sophisticated seeming books. So we will publish those under this Vertigo line. And Sandman was kind of the core comic of that line. Mm-hmm. But tons and tons of British and American authors coming to that with their own series. Transmetropolitan by Warren Ellis, Preacher by Steve Dillon and Garth Ennis, and Grant Morrison, who had been a Scottish writer who had come over to American comics with sort of the late 80s British invasion that brought a lot of those writers from Great Britain over to write for American publishers. Invisibles was his big continuing series. He had written a few one-shots and short miniseries, but this was his big entry into the world of the Vertigo line. And in a lot of ways, the early issues of the Invisibles to me read a lot like he's saying, what do Vertigo comics contain? What is their shape? I will do a comic like that. Mm-hmm. So I see a lot of Sandman tropes in the early issues of Invisibles, that you will have a core set of characters and an arc that will run a certain number of issues. Mm-hmm. And then that'll be broken up by single issue stories that take place in that world, but involve characters that we didn't know before.
Right.
And then we'll go back to another arc of the main storyline. And that's also exactly how the X-Files worked, that there would be the Monster of the Week episode where they would just fight the slimy monster in the sewer, or, you know, a one-off UFO story. And then they would get to a couple episodes of the conspiracy arc.
Right.
And that would sort of keep people going through the season.
And then at another point in the conversation, the mics were off. And we ended up talking about some stuff about time that I caught the end of that I think is important. So I'm going to include it here. Enjoy.
Talked about it all is that time as soil and how we move through time. The imagery of the kind of like time snakes that all of the people are.
Yeah.
And that if we could step outside and see our lives, this isn't our shape. My shape starts in a hospital in Berlin, Vermont, and snakes all over the place to get to here.
Yeah, without actually moving through time. It exists in all those places at once.
Yeah.
Yeah. See also Slaughterhouse-Five, definitely. And also Donnie Darko. I don't know if you know that movie.
Are you finding, as you go through these books, that you are finding lots of connections among the books that you're profiling?
Yeah.
Yeah. I assume.
And some of that is we've been camped out a bit in postmodernism. So some of that is that.
Yeah.
Like it starts to emerge in Catch 22, and then it really, like, it's the central conceit in Slaughterhouse-Five. And it's, you know, and this book is influenced by Slaughterhouse-Five, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, the description of characters as centipedal beings, that's how the Tralfamadorians see. It's described that way in Slaughterhouse-Five.
But no, I'm good to just sort of follow your lead.
That's an important thing about time. I don't want to get too off on a physics tangent, because sometimes I have that thought about light. There's this problem with light, where light, like if you were to travel at the speed of light, time would cease to exist.
Right, yeah.
And so that seems to imply that light exists like those centipedes. If you could take a snapshot of the universe, it would be light.
Right.
All over the place, because the same photons are bouncing all over the place from the beginning to the end, and there's no beginning or end. It's just like a big mosaic of light patterns.
Right.
Which seems to imply predestination to me.
Yeah.
It seems to cancel causality.
If you're light, there is no time.
Right. And if that's the case, then light, I can't divert. If I divert light with a mirror, it was always going to happen that way, because it can't interact with the mirror in time. It can only interact with the mirror outside of time, which is a deep tangent and the topic of a different person's podcast on physics, right? Theoretical physics question.
Jesus, I watch PBS Spacetime, and invariably I get about 3 minutes into it and I'm like, it's lost me, but it's entertaining.
That's where I'm at with Brian Greene's book about string theory. I forget what it's called. The Beautiful Universe or something.
Yeah, I read a lot of cosmology books, and it's just like, it's that stuff where while I'm reading it, it feels like it makes sense.
And then try to explain it.
Because I don't have the math.
Yeah.
And I think if I had some of the math, it would stick better.
Yeah. The Elegant Universe. That's exactly the thing. He's like, if you want the math, it's in the footnotes. And I'll peek at it. And I'm like, yeah. I'm sorry.
But I like popular cosmology.
Thank you for listening to Human Cannonball. And thanks to all the guest hosts and to the authors and all the readers. Intro music is from an untitled improvisation by Miles Walter. Huge props to him for that. And during the summary, you heard Scott Joplin's Maple Leaf Rag as played by August Lindman, but sped up a touch. Many thanks to him for his generous Creative Commons copyright. If you'd like to support the continuance of the Human Cannonball Project, you may be able to do so sometime in the future, and I will let you know when that happens. Much respect, much love, peace.